everyone. Bonjour tout le monde. Welcome to today's webinar. What is Indigenous D data sovereignty and who decides? Honoring data governance principles and respecting self-determination. Before we begin today's webinar, we acknowledge that Bourne, Ontario, hosted at CHEO, is located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe Nation. We honor the enduring presence of Indigenous peoples and their long-standing stewardship of these lands, waters, communities, and knowledge systems. As we gather following National Indigenous Peoples Day, we recognize and celebrate the strength, diversity, and contributions of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples, while also reflecting on the ongoing work of advancing Indigenous rights, self-determination, and reconciliation. Indigenous communities have been knowledge keepers since time immemorial, shaping understandings of health, family, and community that continue to guide us today. As we discuss what is Indigenous data sovereignty and who decides, we recognize that sovereignty extends beyond land to include the right of Indigenous peoples to govern their own information, knowledge, and data according to their own laws, values, and priorities. We are guided by Bourne, Ontario's commitment to Indigenous data sovereignty and to respectful partnerships that support Indigenous leadership in decisions about the collection, use, access, and stewardship of Indigenous data. We also acknowledge that many colleagues are joining from territories across Ontario and beyond, home to diverse First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. We invite you all to take a moment to reflect on the land you are on and the Indigenous peoples who have cared for it since its time immemorial and the responsibilities we each hold in supporting Indigenous self-determination. Today's webinar is being recorded. A recording will be shared with participants as soon as it is available. My name is Mariah, and my role at Bourne is Strategic Partnerships and Network Coordinator. I will be hosting today's webinar. I am joined by my colleague, Tammy Kupfer, Communications Specialist, who will be managing the chat box and other items behind the scenes today. And I am now so pleased to introduce to you today's speaker. Tom Lindsay is of mixed European ancestry and Cree from One Arrow, Saskatchewan, and has worked in the area of Indigenous health in various roles for nearly a decade. Growing up, he spent a lot of time learning about his Indigenous heritage from his grandmother by spending his summer months at Golden Lake Reserve and attending regional powwows. His background is in biology. He is very passionate about everything related to science and loves science fiction, so feel free to geek out with him if you have the chance. Tom's focus at Bourne is to build trust with Indigenous peoples and communities by ensuring Bourne's policies align with Indigenous data governance principles and respect Indigenous data sovereignty. Tom is currently spearheading engagement efforts across the province, fostering long-lasting relationships and building meaningful partnerships grounded in reciprocity, transparency, and cultural humility to support shared decision-making. Also joining us today for the Q&A period of today's webinar is Ian Joyner, Manager of Information Protection at Bourne, Ontario. Thank you so much, Tom and Ian, for joining us today and delivering the webinar. Today, we encourage you to submit your questions at any point using the Q&A box. We'll do our best to address as many as possible during the discussion period following Tom's presentation. And I'll now turn it over to you, Tom, to get us started.
Thank you very much. I trust everyone can see that. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for coming. It's much appreciated. And thank you, Mariah, for that introduction. Today, I'm going to be talking generally about Indigenous data sovereignty and also more specifically about what it can mean to non-Indigenous organizations like Bourne. Especially since Bourne is a registry and doesn't need consent to collect personal health information, how can this be reconciled with Indigenous data sovereignty? We're going to explore that question and more over the next hour or so. So first, a little bit more about me for those who aren't familiar with me or my history in this space. As Murray mentioned, I went to Ottawa U to study biology. After finishing, I wound up at the Wabano Centre for Aboriginal Health as a coordinator and eventually as a team lead for youth programming. I left there to become a policy analyst at Congress of Aboriginal Peoples. Afterwards, around 2022 is actually the first time I came to Bourne. I was covering a maternity leave for about a year. When I had to leave Bourne after my contract was up, I started a position at the Indigenous Physicians Association of Canada, or IPAC, as their membership and mentorship manager, which was great because I got to fly all around the country visiting medical schools and putting on mentorship events for medical students and residents. It was an amazing experience. And afterwards, this position opened up again, so I decided to apply and I made it back. So I'm at Bourne again. So enough about me. Let's get right into it. Why Indigenous data sovereignty matters. For historical context, Indigenous peoples have often been overstudied, misrepresented in study, and also excluded from decision-making about their own data. Research findings about Indigenous people and their communities have sometimes resulted in stigmatization and deficit-based narratives. And that's because communities often had very little control over how their data was interpreted or shared. So, what does Indigenous data sovereignty mean at Bourne? Well, the common definition is the right of Indigenous peoples to govern the collection, ownership, access, interpretation, use, and stewardship of data about their peoples, territories, resources, and communities. Quite often you can ask 10 different people what they think Indigenous data sovereignty means, and you'll get 10 different answers. But by and large, most of them will have these components to them. So, what does this mean for Bourne, Ontario? The way that we define it here is Indigenous data sovereignty means whatever the communities say it means. So if a community, for example, says Indigenous data sovereignty to us means we want you, Bourne, to collect our information regarding X, Y, and Z and protect it for us so that we can access it whenever we want, then that's what it means. It will mean different things to different communities, wherever they happen to be, and will depend on their capacity to collect, store, protect, and analyze data. What this also means is that when it comes to our own policies, we need to be flexible to accommodate individual community needs. Ultimately, this will require a great deal of engagement, but I believe it will be an invaluable investment. Speaking of engagement, we're going to take a brief look at previous engagement efforts at Bourne. All the way back in 2012, Bourne sent letters to 19 different Indigenous organizations requesting to engage on the topic of Indigenous data in our systems. Subsequently, 11 meetings were held with 9 of these organizations, and based on these meetings, a report was produced in 2016 that outlined some recommendations, such as the need for a distinct Indigenous data governance policy and accompanying procedures for properly and responsibly protecting and stewarding Indigenous data, because we didn't have it at the time. It also suggested the stopping of collecting of some Indigenous identifiers, but a little bit more on that later. Additional training for staff was also recommended, which led to Bourne introducing Sanya's Indigenous cultural safety training for all Bourne employees, and this is mandatory. Bourne also afterwards, developed and solidified a comprehensive Indigenous data governance policy, and as well began to reframe engagement models to focus more on community-to-community level engagement. For 2025 and beyond, what we want to do is we want to continue engaging, continue learning, so that we can continue improving our policies and engagement models, so that eventually we can be seen as trusted with the safe use of Indigenous data. So the data collection changes I just mentioned include removing Aboriginal as a distinct identifier for maternal ancestry. Reason being is that there was a high rate of missingness in this data. It was provider assigned instead of self-identified, so it was very unreliable. And there were also concerns that this information wasn't being collected in a safe or culturally appropriate way. The identifiers we do still collect include First Nations as a race for prenatal screening, but this is only because racial group is used in some prenatal screening algorithms to enhance reliability. We also have data on who has been referred to someone conducting the Indigenous Healthy Babies, Healthy Children program. Aboriginal midwife is an option as a healthcare provider. There are various Indigenous languages included for maternal primary language. And also, there's postal codes that can overlap with Indigenous communities and nations. So, we do still collect some identifiers. Some are a little bit more direct, some more proxy. But other than postal code data, it can't really be used to identify any community. And even the postal code data itself isn't that reliable, isn't as reliable as most people think. Postal codes often don't line up well with many Indigenous communities and often include nearby towns that aren't necessarily Indigenous or So we actually have someone here at Bourne who looked at this and made an amazing presentation to demonstrate how postal codes actually aren't a very good proxy for identifying Indigenous communities. So, knowing that we collect some Indigenous identifiable data, we have to talk about how to protect it. And for that, we should quickly go over Indigenous data governance principles. When it comes to our policies, we just call it our Indigenous data governance policy, but that doesn't tell the whole story. Indigenous peoples aren't a monolith, and neither are these data governance principles. For example, for First Nations, the First Nations Information Governance Center, or FNIGC, have developed, coined, and trademarked OCAP principles, which stands for Ownership, Control, Access, and Possession. This is specific to First Nations data and should be weaved into any policy concerning their data. Same for Métis. Developed through the Métis Center of the National Aboriginal Health Organization and endorsed by Manitoba Métis Federation, the main Métis framework is very similar to OCAP, but stewardship has been substituted for possession. I believe the emphasis here is that if Métis data can't all be stored on Métis-owned servers or in Métis communities, then whoever holds the data must become responsible stewards of it. For Inuit, it's slightly different, but similar principles apply and are often wrapped in what's commonly called IQ or Inuit Kayamat. Sorry, this one's tough. Kayamayatakangi. I was speaking to an Inuit woman last week, actually, asking her to help me with my pronunciation of IQ, but she came from a different area with a different accent and laughed when I pronounced it like this. So, my apologies. I didn't have time to learn the new pronunciation in time for this webinar, but I'm working on it. So IQ translates as Inuit traditional knowledge. It was first translated by Rebecca Mike at a meeting of the Nunavut Social Development Council back in 1998. So as you can see, although there are a lot of shared concepts, there is no single or singular Indigenous perspective. That's why what we're doing at Bourne is shifting our policy to a distinctions-based approach to better reflect the distinct rights, governance structures, cultures, priorities, and data sovereignty expectations for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. We believe that this will allow for a lot more flexibility as we engage at the community level and work to accommodate specific community rules and policies concerning health data collection and protection. And of course, we're looking forward to developing these additional policies in collaboration with the communities themselves. As I mentioned at the onset, BORN is a registry, and we can collect data without consent for the purposes of improving the provision of care. It's important to consider the fact that we can't avoid collecting data from Indigenous people. Indigenous peoples need to access the healthcare system, and our mandate is to monitor a part of that system, specifically the part that involves pregnant individuals, newborns, and children for the purposes of improving care. So the question is not should BORN collect Indigenous data, because that's unavoidable. The only way we could actually stop collecting Indigenous data is to ask everyone if they are Indigenous or not, which would pretty much defeat the purpose of protecting the data in the first place or ensuring that it's collected in a safe manner. The question is, how can BORN collect, protect, and steward Indigenous data in a good way that respects these Indigenous data governance principles? In my opinion, it starts with a shift in thinking. Some organizations consider themselves data owners. BORN has often referred to itself as data holders and still does, but when it comes to Indigenous data specifically, we've organized our policies more around data stewardship while incorporating Indigenous data governance principles. We're hoping that over time and with open, honest, and transparent communication, we can be looked upon as trusted partners and relationship builders in this space. There's a very common saying today around the topic of engagement and relationship building. I think I first heard it from Dr. Janet Smiley, and that is relationships move at the speed of trust. And that's what BORN needs to do, establish trust with communities. So, again, as a registry, we can collect data without consent. So, what does this mean for these Indigenous data governance principles? The way I like to think of it, or the analogy that I've been using, is that of a vault. So, if you think of BORN as a vault, then legally, as per PHIPAA and Information Privacy Commission requirements, the data must be protected. It can't be sold or used in a way that isn't aligned with our mandate, which is again to improve the provision of care. As well, our own researchers have to follow the same policies as any other data requester regarding Indigenous data. They have to engage with community first. Just because we have it doesn't mean we're allowed to go ahead and use it. And community data is like a safety deposit box within this vault. Communities alone control and access it. They decide how it's shared, who has properly engaged with them, etc. Their data isn't released without their prior approval. And finally, if communities wish to access this information that BORN has on them, we'll do whatever we can to identify what is their data and hand it over. So, for all intents and purposes, the communities own their data. This is why I see being a registry operating in this very tightly regulated and monitored framework is actually a feature and not a bug, because by law, we have to ensure our vault is secure and state of the art. As well, when either collecting or releasing data that involves an Indigenous identifier or that could potentially identify Indigenous communities or populations, BORN takes additional steps to ensure safe and respectful data governance. Some of these key considerations and protections are, first and foremost, we must ensure the protection of individual privacy. This is paramount. It's what we legally have to do at all times. But we also want to make sure that the data is protected at the community level, so that before any data might be released, we need to ensure meaningful engagement has taken place. And of course, there has to be transparency throughout this entire process. All these considerations are actually embedded within our policies. And just to add a little additional context around the differences between personal and community level data and the considerations that need to be taken into account, especially when it concerns research. First off, individuals are always free to self-identify as Indigenous if they wish. That's their personal right. But we have to remember that inferences or conclusions about the community they are from cannot be derived from this data. And similarly, communities are entitled to access community-level data for reporting and health monitoring, etc., but they're not entitled to individual-level PHI or personal health information. And you can't make assumptions about individuals based on the communities that they're from. So, finding solutions to some of the issues I've been mentioning requires a lot more engagement, but the engagement has to be meaningful. And what that means is it's a good start to define what meaningful engagement isn't. So, engagement is not informing communities after decisions are made. It's not a single email, and it's not a meaningless or a consultation as a meaningless checkbox. Meaningful engagement is early, it's respectful, it leads to long-term ongoing relationships, and very importantly, it's reciprocal. This is why we want to work with communities to find a way to link our data to their members, so that they can quickly and easily access community-level data. We're hoping to find solutions to these issues soon, because if there's one concern among all the communities that I've engaged with, it's how difficult it can be to access high-quality aggregate data on their members and in a timely fashion. So, just to give you a practical example of what Bourne is doing in this space, we are actually trying to implement Indigenous self-ID at select pediatric diabetes education programs, or PDEPs. These are the diabetes clinics inside hospitals that specialize in pediatric care. Now, before this implementation can happen, our plan is to engage Indigenous communities and organizations in conjunction with the PDEP. In the vicinity of these PDEPs to determine if and where there are diabetes programs or cultural supports that exist in their area, so that these supports can be offered to the Indigenous patients. We also want to know what self-ID would look like for their community. For example, how the questions should be worded, or how they should be asked, what training might be necessary or would definitely be necessary for data collectors, and also what additional information could be useful for the community in terms of health monitoring that we could actually add to this form. So we're really hoping to build and implement this in full collaboration with communities and Indigenous organizations. It will require a lot of conversations. We're going to be asking a lot of questions, but we're really looking forward to it because we want to do this in the right way. On the topic of continued learning and asking questions, a very talented young lady by the name of Riley Restoul agreed to answer some questions I sent her on the topic of Indigenous data sovereignty. This was very serendipitous. Really, I was in a committee meeting hosted by the Northern Maternal Child Network. Someone mentioned the Anishinaabeg Nation website, so I went to go check it out. And under podcasts, I noticed that there was a title, Indigenous Data Sovereignty by Riley Restoul. And I thought, wait, I'm in a meeting with her right now. I should just reach out. So I did. I sent her some questions about Indigenous data sovereignty and Bourne from the perspective of someone living in community. And she graciously agreed to produce a short video for me answering them. So without further ado, here's Riley Restoul.
Hello everyone, my name is Riley Restoul. I'm from Doki's First. Nation, and I am their clan. I'm Anishinaabe and Franco-Ontarian. I work as the clinical research coordinator of Indigenous Health at the Health Sciences North Research Institute, and my main focus is on developing Indigenous data sovereignty protocols with our communities that we serve and within the organization. I'm also a PhD student at the University of Saskatchewan, and I'm studying perinatal health policy through the lens of Tikkanoggins. Indigenous data sovereignty can take on many different meanings and hold many definitions depending on the community or organization. At the Health Sciences North Research Institute, we have yet to establish an official data governance protocol when working with Indigenous communities, but we're in the consultation phase with many different communities and Indigenous organizations. Generally speaking, Indigenous data sovereignty means that Indigenous peoples have control over their data and can choose how it's handled and talked about. In practice, this may look like developing clear methods to enact data governance frameworks such as OCAP, working alongside Indigenous communities to develop projects involving their data, and publishing information that reports in a strengths-based fashion with consent from community. Like I previously mentioned, Indigenous data sovereignty is defined differently by different communities. So it's important to treat data like a gift, and it's important to remember that each number, biological sample, story, or teaching, all those things come from our relatives, whether that's a person, an animal, a plant, the water, or an item. We need to honor that. I think that various concerns come up when we think of non-Indigenous organizations collecting health data on Indigenous peoples, whether this data is identifiable or not. First, there are concerns regarding safety. There's always a concern about how data is collected, stored, and shared. So ensuring that these processes are safeguarded, both from an IT and from a cultural perspective, is key. Each community will have their own perspective on what safe data practices are. Therefore, we need to make space for all of these safeguards throughout all of our processes. Then there's concerns regarding culture and protocol, and I hear those quite often. Some information is considered sacred, things like ceremonial practices, some songs, teachings, and stories. They aren't meant to be recorded in any way. So when caring for patients, these things can sometimes come up, and it's important to always be mindful of what is collected, because we don't want to break protocol with our sacred knowledge. Next, the idea of reciprocity is foundational in Indigenous culture. So we need to ensure that non-Indigenous organizations are asking questions that are actually meaningful. What I mean by this is something needs to result from the information being collected. We can't ask people for their time, information, and to perform any sort of labor just because we're interested in knowing something out of curiosity. The collected information absolutely needs to be in regards to a project that aligns with community needs and interests, and it needs to have a tangible end result. Sometimes projects result in a new approach, new policies, or a toolkit, for example. And essentially, information should never be collected based off of personal or organizational interest without any intention of benefiting the community. Next, there's many concerns surrounding data presentation. Historically, information about Indigenous peoples has been disproportionately represented in a deficit-based manner. Reporting through a negative lens, which often reinforces dangerous ideologies. So, as individuals and organizations responsible for reporting on this data, it's important to report from a strengths-based perspective as much as possible. Sharing positive stories and successful practices is extremely important. I think that through consistent and open communication with the individuals and communities that we're working with, this data and these stories can be represented in a way that's respectful and aligns with everyone's needs. Finally, to touch specifically on the point of data that's not tagged as Indigenous, depending on the nature of the project, not tagging the information could actually lead to greater gaps within the health system. There already exists a major gap in Indigenous people's health data, with many aspects of healthcare being underreported or misunderstood. So the added context of data being flagged as Indigenous could actually help contribute to a better understanding of current issues, which could help leverage things like funding or to find solutions to health inequities experienced by Indigenous peoples specifically. Honestly, overall, I think that all these concerns can be addressed through consistent, open, and honest communication. It's important to involve community at all stages of the data collection project. Respectful and trustworthy data practices look like whatever the community or communities involved in a project want them to look like. Overall, respectful and trustworthy practices mean community-led practices. This means that the community is involved from project conception to the final stage, and communication should absolutely continue once the project is complete. We'll often hear things about relationship building, but I think that many people think that this relationship ends once a project is complete. But good partnerships and collaborations are those that remain active regardless of a project. Those relationships shouldn't hinge on a transaction, like a project. Additionally, respectful and trustworthy data practices cannot realistically be standardized. Frameworks like OCAP are incredibly useful, but they can't be used like a checkbox. It's important to not only consult with community, but actively involve community as a participant at all stages of a project. Doing this will ensure that all concerns are addressed along every step of the way. I don't know that I can answer specifically to the question, what helps build trust? Because trust isn't something that's built or asked of someone. Trust is something that's given independently over time. One piece of advice that's specifically geared towards non-Indigenous organizations is that it's important to begin relationships and go into projects without an agenda. It's absolutely okay to have a plan. It's okay to ask questions. And truthfully, those questions are the most important piece of relationship building. However, you might get answers that you aren't expecting. Those answers might not align with what you were hoping would happen. You might even be told no or that it isn't time yet. And it's really important to honor that because those responses come from somewhere with a lot of knowledge. Ultimately, I think the situation will vary depending on the project and community. So my best advice to this topic would again be to spend time in community and allow them to lead the way. A good relationship between data stewards and Indigenous communities is a relationship that is communicative, open, reciprocal, committed to ongoing learning, and that does not only exist within a certain project. I can't stress enough how important it is to ensure that community voices are at the forefront of all work being done that involves Indigenous data. The only way to achieve this is to communicate and remain supportive of community. When I'm invited to speak, I always take the time to recognize the work and the people that have come before me. Our people have been scientists since time immemorial. We just maybe didn't call it science. Many trailblazers have come before me and people in my generation who are doing this type of work with data. And those who came before us broke down barriers and created the spaces that exist today. The fact that I'm an Indigenous health researcher at a large academic health sciences center is huge. And it's only possible because of those people who spent their lives doing this important work. And while it's really amazing to be doing this type of work, it can definitely get difficult. I do what I'm doing today to make the world a better place for those who are coming after me. This is why it's so important to support future researchers and healthcare professionals that are Indigenous. Our people should be taking up space in these positions. So support your students and make space for Indigenous voices in your organizations. Thank you, Miigwech.
There we go. A huge thank you to Riley for sharing her perspective. And again, I really appreciate her taking the time to produce this for us. I hope I get to return the favor. someday. Moving on, here at Bourne, we are slowly but surely growing our network. And one of the reasons is, and I live by this mantra, is the more information or data we have, the better conclusions and decisions we can make. So with a larger network, we can attain better data interpretation for improved contextual understanding of research findings, which hopefully can lead to reduced risk of harm. We want to build better relationships so that we can improve trust and, as Riley mentioned in the video, form stronger relationships that are reciprocal in nature. We also want better outcomes. It's in our name, so that we can collect more useful data, have more useful evidence, and have stronger and more beneficial partnerships, especially with organizations like Indigenous clinics and health authorities. So, taking a look at what we would like to see in the future, first off, related to the Indigenous self-ID work that I mentioned earlier, we would like to eventually map out specific diabetes and Indigenous cultural supports for all of those PDEP clinics in the province so that they can advertise and refer their Indigenous patients to them. We would like to work with Indigenous midwifery practices if they want to help bring birthing back to community by helping them secure their own data and offer access to provincial reports so that they can compare their own stats. In fact, we already have an Indigenous midwifery practice accessing our aggregate monthly reports. And finally, I would really like to create some kind of Indigenous-specific database separate from the Bourne databases that's full of Indigenous community-level data so that communities can access it directly at any time. I feel that this would maximize OCAP compliance because arguably the P in OCAP, possession, is the most contested part of OCAP. It's what most people would argue we're not really respecting because the communities don't possess the data. Technically, we do. But this database would essentially be an outward community-facing portal populated by their data where they have full control over it. So again, the vault would be ours, but everything inside of it would be theirs. It's like a lockbox, and only they possess the key. So that's all I have for you today. Thank you for listening. It's been great sharing the work that we've been doing and where we'd like to go in the near future. I think we're about to take some questions, but if you think of something you'd like to ask after the webinar is over, please feel free to reach out to me at any time. My email is at the bottom of the page here, and thanks again.
Miigwech, thank you, Tom, for speaking about Indigenous data sovereignty and adding the discussion as well with Riley Rastulli. As we've discussed today, it's really clear that there's no one-size-fits-all answer to what Indigenous data sovereignty is, but it's about governance, self-determination, relationships, and accountability. You really emphasized how there must be an ongoing dialogue and a commitment to respectful partnership, as this is essential as we navigate the evolving landscape together. And with that said, we'd like to open the floor for any questions, reflections, and discussion. So, using the Q&A box, please feel free to add your questions. I'll begin with a pre-submitted question. And it is around when Bourne began collecting statistics for Indigenous birthing people in Ontario.
For that, I believe it was at the onset of Bourne. It did look very differently. As I mentioned in the presentation, it wasn't like just Indigenous or First Nations, Métis, Inuit specific. It just said Aboriginal. But a lot has changed in that time, and we want to continue making these changes so that we can improve not only care, but also how we can share this data back to the community so that it can be useful.
Okay, thanks, Tom. And you spoke a lot about respectful engagement. So, what does respectful engagement look like when an organization already possesses historical Indigenous data?
It's always like for me, there is like a general process that I have for respectful engagement. I mean, obviously there are parts of it like we have to acknowledge what has happened in the past. We have to acknowledge that we have this. We have to be like I said in the presentation, open, honest, and transparent. We have to acknowledge perhaps some of our faults or shortcomings. But you know, we are trying to get to a place where we can really work collaboratively with others. And one of the main things I always tell people, especially because a lot of people come to me and ask me how they should go about engaging. And the first thing I always tell them is do your pre-engagement research. It's like the most important step. You can't just go into these conversations blind with no knowledge of the community, the language they speak, what treaty they're protected, or what treaty covers them. You know, going in with just even that level of understanding of their community and perhaps a bit of their history and their needs. Perhaps you can find some information on what some of their priorities might be so that you can help out. Yeah, that's the most important step is just learn more about them. And then when you do engage, just listen because, you know, we are storytellers. And what I find is that if you are respectful and you go in there with this attitude and that you just want to listen and learn, they will tell you everything.
Wonderful. Listen and learn and do research ahead of time. Thank you, Tom. And if you could give one piece of advice to organizations who are just beginning this journey, what would it be?
Don't rush. It's a slow process. It takes time. As I mentioned before, you know, this relationship building moves at the speed of trust, and you have to show that you can be a trustworthy partner. So, you know, again, be engaged, be interested, learn more, you know, come at this from a position of humility, because you know, like even myself personally, I don't know a lot about most communities in Ontario, and I love learning more about them. So you can see like when you're engaging with them, they can get the sense of this eagerness to learn more about them and for sharing. And yeah, if that's the attitude that you go in with, then you should be fine. But yeah, don't expect everything all at once. It takes time.
Thanks, Tom. And there's a question here in the Q&A from Andrea. And Andrea is asking, is there a way for communities to know what has been done for other groups or communities or what Bourne could possibly offer? So, for example, the onus is not on the community to come up with the question, but instead decide if they want to pursue it.
Yeah, that's interesting because before I started going to different various conferences, that was actually a question that I asked to my Bourne colleagues, and I got a lot of amazing responses. So I asked them like, what sort of questions can you answer with Bourne data? Because you know, whenever you're asking a scientific question like that, and you're looking at the data that could be related to it, there are certain data elements that can answer that question that can't. Sometimes the question has to be modified somehow so that the data you have can actually be applicable to it. And so when I ask them, like, what all can we find out with this data, they came back with a huge form full of information, different questions. So they would say things like, well, if you want to answer this question, you can use these data elements, and this is how you would get the answer. So I think it would be Like it would be a good idea for us to develop that more and put it on the website so that communities and organizations know what sort of questions they our data can be answering. And I think every organization that holds Indigenous data should be doing the same. They should be, well, first of all, they should know exactly what they have and what they don't. That would be a very good first start. But then also, running this type of analysis where you can put out beforehand the types of questions that you can ask and can be answered from their data or in conjunction with other data.
Wonderful. Thanks for that fulsome response, Tom. And there's a question here from Farzina asking, how would you suggest to engage respectfully when you are in a large urban center where there are Indigenous individuals from all over the country? So they're not just belonging to one treaty or having one set of priorities.
Oh yeah, that's a good question. I think in a lot of instances, the same general rules apply. Like, so you're not, if you're doing your background research, perhaps you're not learning about a community, but like a specific community. But you can dig into what it's like to be Indigenous in that urban setting. And I'm just thinking back to my Wabano days. You can get a really good idea of what the community needs based on the type of programming that might be available in the area. So we had a lot of focus on youth programming to make sure that the youth always had something to do or somewhere to go that could be a safe place for them. We had a lot of early childhood programming, stuff like parenting classes and that. So it's good to do a lot of that research. It's very different research from when you're conducting it on a specific community, but you can still learn quite a bit. And a lot of the times, these organizations will have like some kind of navigator or not so much a PR person, but program managers and stuff, and they can give you a really good sense of the pulse of the community and some of the needs and deficits that exist. So kind of the same general rule applies. Just do your research, learn what you can about them, learn what their demographics are, like who are these indigenous groups, where do they come from, where are they from primarily.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And this next question is around the theme of trust. I think it's an interesting question from Jessica. Since BORN doesn't need consent to collect data, how does this look like when working with Indigenous communities?
Well, I tell you, I've had a lot of engagements with different people from different communities, mostly from all over the North. And when I explain that we are collecting this data not for engagement purposes but for monitoring, because like our purpose, our mandate is to monitor the healthcare system. We want to make sure it gets better and not worse. So the data that we're collecting itself is for that purpose and not for research. And even though we are collecting the data without consent, if we are going to do research on it, you're going to hear about it because we have to have your permission to use it. That distinction, the distinction between what is research and what is like healthcare or system monitoring, is a huge distinction for BORN. And even though it seems like on one side, on the reporting side, it doesn't feel like we might be honoring Indigenous data sovereignty as well as we could, some of the solutions that I mentioned in the presentation are ways to mitigate those concerns and build trust in the communities that, yes, even though we are collecting this data, it is being handled responsibly. And what I think one of those, like one sure sign that we are doing our best to respect these principles is finding ways to give the data back so that it's useful and helpful to them. Because if we're going to be taking this data in, it has to go back out for them to help them.
Thank you, Tom. And this next question is around who makes decisions in a community or for a community, given provincial, federal, and other providers, etc. Do you have any suggestions to help data get to those decision makers as they're making decisions so they can be informed?
Yeah, that's a difficult question because it really changes depending on where you go. There are every community, not every community, but most communities will have varying governance structures as it pertains to like data collection and use and control and access. And this is one of those instances where some communities are more advanced than others. Sometimes the communities just don't, the communities themselves, the specific ones, don't want to deal with this sort of thing on their own. So there are like overseeing more, not governing bodies, but representative bodies that can do a lot of this work for them. And a lot of the times these larger networks will know. And often the like those networks will be like the whoever controls or whoever is a part of those networks are from the communities themselves. So when you are engaging this network, you are in fact engaging various specific communities in the area because there's representation from everyone. So yeah, that takes a lot of homework. It's something I've been working on for a really long time. There's a lot of overlap, which makes it even more complicated. So there are a lot of factors in this, but yeah, if you're really serious about getting out there and mapping out the space, you're going to need to take the time, and you're going to need the patience to do it.
Thanks, Tom. And this next question is from Kate, and it's about looking for province-wide or across Canada, countrywide data about Indigenous health outcomes. This person is personally passionate about maternal mortality. So I wonder, Tom, if you can speak more about your experience working in this space or what you know about working in this space.
For like province-wide and
For
country-wide.
exactly for see for obtaining province-wide or national data about Indigenous health outcomes.
Well, it is difficult for in both instances because the borders around these different communities sometimes don't line up with the borders that Canada has laid out. And so when you're trying to gather data from province to province, it, you know, whatever, like for us, for example, as soon as you leave Ontario, it's a void. It's a data void. So getting usable, comparable data from across the country would be extremely difficult. I'm not sure who has it. Perhaps CIHI or ICES, but I'm not very familiar with what they have in terms of like pan, you know, Turtle Island data, unfortunately. But it's a good question. I'll look into that, and I would like to get back to you.
Sounds like there's a lot of complexities to consider there.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Tom. And we have time for one remaining question. So I am going to ask, what gives you hope when you look at the current landscape of Indigenous data governance?
What I've been seeing is, so for example, you know, when I first jumped into this space at Wabno, I was fresh out of university. I was a, like a numbers and stats nerd. And I knew the benefits and potentials of collecting high quality data and how it can be used to make your case and to improve something like, healthcare, the healthcare system itself. And at that time, I think I was not a thing. I was definitely a lot more ignorant of the past and how data was misused. So a lot of the times where the people I was working with or other organizations I was engaging with, they either weren't collecting good information, good data, or if they were, they didn't want to share it with anyone, and they weren't using it for anything because there was this fear that it would be taken and it would be misused. And that was perfectly justified at the time. But I've seen over the past several years this shift, as if the power of data has kind of become recognized now. And now the I'm glad to see that not just us and not just the organizations that I've been talking to, but a lot of individual communities really coming to understand the power of data, the importance of collection, and how to collect it safely. So there's been this shift, this massive shift from no, we're not going to do anything with you, no collecting data, no nothing, to yeah, okay, let's collect the data and then let's implement these indigenous data data principles to protect it. Right. So as like I mentioned before, it's not, stop collecting. Now it's yes, sure, collect it. But now we want to make sure that it's done properly. And that's encouraging because it was engaging in this space before and talking about any conversation about data collection, it was almost like an immediate wall came up, and breaking through that wall was very difficult. But I find a lot of people out there, a lot of organizations, a lot of communities, they're a lot more open to this and forming these relationships and these partnerships. And especially if, I tell them like who I am, where I'm from, and what we're trying to do. So when I go out in the community and I say, I don't want anything from you. I want to give you back your own data so that you can use it. How do we do that? The attitude changes instantly, and it goes from, the protective barrier to a very welcoming one. So that's very encouraging, and that gives me hope that as we get the ball rolling on this, hopefully it will snowball and word will get out that this is what Bourne is trying to do, and we're trying to form more partnerships and we're trying to get more data out there for communities, and then we can start really making a difference for them.
What a lovely note to end on. Thank you for that message of hope, Tom. And thank you so much for leading this important conversation today. And we want to thank everyone who took the time to attend the webinar today to learn more about Indigenous data sovereignty.
Thank you.
So you're welcome for those who are attending to join us for upcoming webinars. You'll also be prompted to complete a post-webinar survey. We so appreciate you taking the time to complete this. Thank you all again, once again, for your time today. We truly appreciate your attendance and interest in this important work.